Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight we enter the dazzling yet perilous world of the 1930s circus, where applause masks rivalries, love becomes a contest, and one fatal performance turns art into tragedy. This is Poirot and the Fall from Heaven, an original mystery written by us in homage to Agatha Christie, inspired by a chilling true story from the golden age of the Big Top. Creating these mysteries, writing, narration, and sound takes many hours each week. Likes, comments, and subscriptions don't just flatter us. They truly shape how far Nocturnal Tales can travel. If you'd like to go further, you can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive extras, or leave a small tip via Buy Me a Coffee. The links are in the description. And since Halloween week approaches, we'd love to hear from you. What's your idea for a spooky mystery we could write next week? Share your plot ideas in the comments, the eerier the better. Now the band begins to play, the lights rise beneath the tent, and somewhere above, an angel prepares to fall. Chapter 1. The Woman in Midair. There are few sights more daring to the human imagination than that of a woman suspended in space, poised between the earth and the heavens. I have seen soldiers leap from aeroplanes and acrobats tumble from dizzying heights, but never had I witnessed grace quite like that of Miss Lillian Leitzel as she spun, whirled, and seemed to float upon invisible wings above the packed amphitheatre of Chicago's Grand Winter Circus. She was not young, nor precisely beautiful, but she possessed that magnetism that transcends both. Her audience adored her. When she stepped into the single loop of silk that hung from the dome, the chatter of thousands fell away as if at the raising of a priest's hand. Then came the drum roll, the blare of the band, and she was lifted, no, she ascended, into a column of light. At my side, Poirot leaned forward, his gloved hands pressed together, the tips of his fingers touching lightly. "Mon ami," he murmured, "behold the paradox of woman, fragile in aspect, yet possessing the audacity of the gods." "Splendid, isn't she?" I said, rather breathless myself. "They say she performs the spin 100 times without touching ground." "So they say," replied Poirot, his eyes following her as she rose higher. "But even the angels, Hastings, have their moment of fall." He said it softly with that peculiar gravity of his, and at the time I thought it a poetic remark. Only later did I recall it with a shiver. The act was reaching its climax. Miss Leitzel grasped the ring by one wrist and began to whirl. Round and round she went, her small body gathering speed until she was little more than a glimmering flame against the dark vault of the tent. The crowd gasped, some cried out, then the drumbeat ceased, and she hung motionless, the embodiment of triumph. She bowed from her height, smiled, and was lowered slowly toward the earth. The applause was thunderous. Poirot clapped politely, though without enthusiasm. "Remarkable," he said, "but I prefer my feet upon solid ground." I laughed. "You've never had the soul of an acrobat, Poirot."
"No, Hastings."
"I have the soul of a man who values the bones of his legs. Our host for the evening, a florid gentleman named Mr. Sullivan, manager of the Grand Winter Circus, turned in his seat. Quite the picture, eh, gentlemen? That's our star, that is. Miss Leitzel's the best thing to happen to us since Prohibition." Poirot inclined his head. "A fine artiste indeed, Monsieur Sullivan. And the gentleman who follows her, the one with the trapeze, he is her partner?" "Her husband, more or less," said Sullivan with a wink. "Alfredo Codona, Mexican fellow, handsome devil. They were the rage of Europe till they brought their act over here. Bit of temper between them, mind you, makes for good publicity."
"Ah,"
Poirot's moustache quivered. A husband and wife, rivals in love and in art. That can produce fireworks, n'est-ce-pas? The fireworks came sooner than anyone imagined. After the performance, we were invited backstage. Poirot, though pretending reluctance, never refused a chance to study human nature at close quarters. The air behind the curtain was thick with grease paint, sawdust, and the mingled perfume of animals and applause. Performers passed in a kaleidoscope of color, clowns, jugglers, equestrians, each half-transformed, half-undone by the effort of illusion. Miss Leitzel received us in a small dressing room, hung with crimson drapery and perfumed with lilies. She was wrapped in a robe of white silk, her hair damp from exertion, her arms dusted with chalk. In person, she was smaller than she appeared from the stalls, her features delicate yet alive with energy. "So you're the famous detective," she exclaimed, her accent vaguely continental. "They told me you solved that business in the theatre in New York last year." Poirot bowed. "Madame exaggerates. I was merely of service to the police. But tonight it is you who have given us delight." Her eyes sparkled. "You liked it, yes?" "Alfredo says I spin too long, that I make the audience dizzy." "But they love it. They must love it, else why would I live like this?" I ventured a gallant compliment, but she seemed scarcely to hear. The door burst open, and a man strode in without ceremony, a dark, handsome fellow. This was Alfredo Codona. His shirt was open at the throat, his hair damp and curling. He looked at Leitzel with something between admiration and reproof. "So you're still talking," he said shortly. "You were supposed to be at the doctor's." "The shoulder again?" she shrugged. "It is nothing. Always he worries, as if I were a child." "It's the cable, Lily." "It slipped again tonight. I saw it from above. If I hadn't signaled the rigger—" She cut him off with a laugh that sounded brittle. "Always the rigger, the rope, the safety. I tell you, I am not afraid." He turned to us abruptly. "She thinks she can fly," he said. "One day she'll find out she can't." Poirot's eyes, small and keen, flicked from one to the other. "You love her very much, monsieur," he said quietly. Codona gave a short, bitter laugh. "Love?" "Yes. That's what makes the circus dangerous." We took our leave shortly thereafter. Outside, the night was raw, the street lamps haloed in mist. Poirot drew his coat about him. "A curious pair, Hastings."
"You think they quarreled?"
"Mais oui. With passion, always passion. But there is more." "Did you observe the manner in which he looked at the rigger when he spoke of the cable?"
"Not particularly."
"He looked at a man he hates."
"That is a dangerous thing, mon ami, when one's wife hangs by that man's rope."
I laughed uneasily.
"Surely you're not suggesting—"
"I suggest nothing. But mark my words. Where jealousy walks the wire, a fall may follow. The following night we dined with an acquaintance of mine, an American correspondent named Jim Beasley, who knew every whisper of the entertainment world. When I mentioned our visit to the circus, his expression changed.
"Leitzel and Codona?"
"You don't say. That marriage is dynamite, Captain. Everyone in the business knows it. She's the queen, and he can't stand being her consort. Used to be the greatest flyer alive till that tumble in 1929. Now he's groundbound and she's up there alone. You think that sits well with him?" Poirot sipped his coffee thoughtfully. "Resentment in the shadow of love. Always the most perilous of mixtures. And the husband? He controls the equipment?"
"Mostly.
He and the head rigger, a fellow named Chapman. Fine mechanic. Doesn't drink, which is rare around these parts." Poirot nodded slowly.
"Tell me, Monsieur Beasley, do they insure the artistes, these circuses?"
"Sure do. Big money, especially for stars like Leitzel. The owner's got a policy that'd make your head spin. Why do you ask?" But Poirot only smiled. It is a little curiosity of mine.
2 evenings later, the tragedy occurred. The house was packed. Miss Lightsell, radiant in scarlet sequins, ascended to her ring amid a sea of light. Poirot and I sat in the same box as before. I remember turning to him just as she began her spin. "She seems even higher tonight," I said. "Yes," murmured Poirot. "Perhaps the gods wished a better view." At the 60-second spin, the cable jerked once, twice, and snapped. There was a sound that I shall never forget, a collective intake of breath, a cry, the drum's sudden silence. She fell like a white flame extinguished, striking the boards with a sickening thud. For an instant, no one moved. Then pandemonium. Screams, the crash of instruments, the rush of men. Poirot remained seated, his face immobile, his eyes fixed upon the dangling end of the broken cable. When at last he rose, it was with infinite calm. "Come, Hastings," he said. "It is already too late for the poor lady." But perhaps not too late for the truth. The scene in the ring was chaos. Doctors knelt beside the fallen woman. Performers wept openly. Cadorna pushed through them, his face ghastly. He threw himself down beside her, crying her name. Poirot watched a moment, then turned away. "Broken neck," murmured one of the physicians. "Instantaneous." Sullivan, the manager, was white as chalk. "God help us. The press'll eat me alive. It must have been the rigging. I'll have Chapman's hide for this." Poirot touched his arm. "You will have many things, Monsieur Sullivan, but first you will have the police, for I think perhaps this was no accident." He stooped and picked from the sawdust a small fragment of twisted wire. Holding it up delicately, he observed, "See, Hastings, the wire, she has been cut. Not frayed by strain, not broken by chance. Cut." And he looked upward, where the light still trembled, as if the heavens themselves had witnessed the crime. Chapter 2. The Man Who Looked Up. If battlefields teach a man to look down, to read the earth for its tracks and tremors, then the circus teaches him to look up. That night in Chicago, I learned the lesson with a shudder. All eyes in the great amphitheater had been wrenched skywards by catastrophe, and now, in the stunned hush after the doctors pronounced the end, the same eyes kept straying toward the void where, moments before, a woman had seemed to dwell among the rafters. Poirot, as ever, did not stare long. His glance rose, fixed, and then returned to the immediate and the small. The things that could be held in the hand, weighed, smelt, turned over to catch a glint of truth. He had recovered from the sawdust a tight curl of bright strand, steel, no thicker than a quill, twisted upon itself like a withered spring. "Cut," he had said. Presently the police arrived, brisk and uncomfortable amid grease paint and sequins. The officer in charge, a square man with a melancholy moustache who introduced himself as Lieutenant O'Rourke, took one look at Poirot's visiting card and sighed, as if Providence had sent both solution and trouble in the same envelope. "You're the Belgian gentleman been helping in New York and Boston," he said. "Well, sir, if you'll keep by me and not over me, I'd be obliged." "My dear Lieutenant," said Poirot with a bow, "I walk beside no man. I shuffle, I mince, sometimes I waddle, but I never walk over. You shall have my observations, and I shall profit by your good sense. D'accord?" O'Rourke's moustache twitched. "D'accord," he said, mangling the syllables with the gallantry of an Irishman abroad. We were still in the ring, the great glare dimmed now to a workman's light. A handful of performers clustered in knots, speaking under their breath as if afraid of waking something. Mr. Sullivan, the manager, paced with a face like sweat, alternately cursing and promising the moon to anyone who would listen. Near the shattered spot where the star had fallen, Alfredo Cadorna sat on an overturned drum, his head in his hands. No one touched him. "Where's your head rigger?" O'Rourke demanded.
A tall, raw-boned man detached himself from the shadows near the mast. He had eyes of an extraordinarily cold blue, and the stillness of a man who lived above the ground and had brought some of its silence down with him.
"Chapman," he said, as if answering a muster roll.
"Frank Chapman."
"Lieutenant," Poirot murmured, "permit that we go where the truth was prepared, in the heights."
O'Rourke looked up and grimaced. "You don't get me on a ladder, Mr. Poirot."
"But I can spare a man to go with you.
Captain Hastings?"
"I'm at your service,"
I said stoutly, though the prospect of catwalks and dizzy perspectives did not delight me. Chapman led us by a narrow stair within the mast. The world of the ring fell away. We emerged into a realm of rigging, beams, and slung platforms that wavered in currents of unseen air. Above, the roof was a ribcage. Below, Chicago seemed a notion someone had once had and then forgotten. Chapman moved with soundless certainty.
"Her rig's up there," he said.
"Independent line to the crown. Redundant clips. We check 'em before each show." I checked 'em. He set a lantern down on the catwalk and knelt. There, at the anchorage where a sleek metal line vanished into the darkness above, he pointed to an exposed segment near the clip. Poirot bent, peering.
"Ah."
Even my novice's eye detected something unnatural. The bright strands of the cable stopped abruptly, hacked into a snarling fringe with a smoothness that was more wicked than ragged. Near the bight, a faint dust glittered when Poirot breathed upon it.
"You use the Rosin, yes?" he asked.
"For hands," said Chapman. "Not on a cable. Clings too much. That," he added reluctantly, "that's metal dust. Fresh, to judge by the sheen."
"A file," I suggested.
Chapman's mouth hardened. "Could be a frame saw. Jewelers use 'em. So do wire walkers and magic boys."
"And riggers?" Poirot asked almost kindly.
"If I wanted to cut a line, I wouldn't do it here," Chapman answered without heat. "You cut where the eye don't fall."
"This cut,"
he looked away.
"This cut was meant to be seen by a man who knows where to look."
Poirot's fingers hovered over the clip but did not touch. He turned the lantern a fraction, and something, a thread, caught the light at the edge of the catwalk, teased by the draught. It was not a thread, but a hair-thin ribbon the color of pale smoke, tied in a sailor's knot to a bolt. He lifted it delicately on the tip of a pencil. It had, unmistakably, a scent.
"Violet," I said, surprised at my own nose.
Poirot's eyes softened.
"We."
We descended with our trophies, one pinch of glittering dust in an envelope, one ghost of ribbon sealed in another. O'Rourke was interrogating Mr. Sullivan near the bandstand, and Chapman slipped away with the noiselessness of his kind. Poirot touched my elbow and indicated a corner where a half-painted clown sat smoking with the intensity of a man who had found in tobacco the only sensible explanation the world offered.
"Pardon, Monsieur le Clown," said Poirot. "You have the look of one who sees all and tells little. It is often the gift of your fraternity."
"The clown," his white face smeared, his red smile turned down by sweat, cocked an eye.
"They call me Pipo," he said in a voice pleasantly cracked. "We make the audience look where the master of ceremonies wants 'em to. That's our trick. Me, I look where nobody's supposed to."
"And tonight," said Poirot.
"Somebody was on the gallery after the cue bell," Pipo answered promptly. "Little after 9. I was crossing for my gag, bucket, wig, the lot. And I hear the bell for Lightsell's lift. Then I hear a fizz.
You been in a machine shop?
That little singing when the blade bites?
I look up, habit. Saw a shadow where there oughtn't to be one near the crown block.
You recognize this shadow?" I asked.
Pipo shook his head.
"Too high, too fast.
But I saw someone come down off the gallery a minute later. Not down the mast stairs, down the electrician's ladder on the west."
"The electrician," said Poirot softly. "He is here.
Name's Eddie Malloy, we call him Sparks. Cocky lad. Does miracles with cue lamps and straw hats? I ain't seen him since the crash, nor his girl.
His girl? I said.
Pippo took a deep breath and blew out a cloud that made a ghost of his painted tear. Greta Kappel. Flyer's understudy. Blonde, hard as a tap shoe. She's been angling for Lily's slot since Christmas. We found Lieutenant O'Rourke and related what we had learned. He scratched under his collar with an air of gloomy satisfaction. The electrician's ladder, eh? We can find this Malloy.
But it was not Eddie Malloy whom we found first. It was the dazzling female the circus had been missing in our little gallery of suspects, and she arrived as if the ring itself had conjured her, on a perfume of violets that made my earlier guess seem less clever and more inevitable. She came with a pair of white stallions, dancing at her wrists, and a black groom hanging on to their heads for dear life. The horses tossed silver manes and struck sparks from the hard ground. She, in a riding habit of midnight blue trimmed with an absurdity of crystals, walked as if the beasts trod to her music.
"Clear a space, Carlo," she said to the groom, her voice darkly amused. "If they stand still, they will think, and if they think, they will be afraid. Men and horses are alike in that."
"Miss Celeste Minotti," Sullivan groaned. "For the love of... Celeste, my darling, this is no parade."
She gave him a look that suggested he was a tolerable fool. Then she saw Cadona sitting alone on the drum, flinched almost imperceptibly, and controlled it with admirable art.
"Alfredo," she said, not quite a question.
He did not look up.
"Take your horses away, Celeste."
"Not until I see that you are..." She stopped, swallowed the tender word, and turned to us with a little bow. "You are the detective." She did not ask, she knew. Poirot inclined his head. "Celeste Minotti," she went on, "the equestrienne. I am French by birth, Italian by mistake, American by contract. If you require it, I can be something else by dinner."
"It is sometimes useful," said Poirot, smiling, "to be Belgian by temperament."
A flicker of laughter touched her mouth and was gone. Up close, she was even more striking. Not a beauty in the English pastoral sense, but all chiaroscuro. Pale skin, black hair coiled in shining ropes, eyes that held light as the ring catches a thrown knife. And there, about her throat, a narrow ribbon of pale grey silk tied in a bow. Violets clung to her as a signature.
"I came as soon as I heard," she said more soberly. "The city hums. I was at the stables, working Sultan. They told me..."
She glanced once more at Cadona and stopped again.
"What do you require of me, monsieur?"
"For the moment," said Poirot, "only your patience and a little truth."
"I am a performer," she said. "Truth is a costume we wear in private. You may have mine."
She gave her horses to the groom and followed us to Sullivan's office, a den that smelled of tobacco and accounts. O'Rourke joined us, flipping open a notebook. Celeste sat straight, hands quiet in her lap, bridal gloves of pearl grey folded upon themselves like thoughtful pigeons.
"You were acquainted with Miss Leitzel," O'Rourke began. "We worked in the same ring."
"You quarrelled," he suggested.
"With Lily,"
Celeste considered. "We were women in the same palace. There are quarrels that one does not lower to words."
"Jealousy," O'Rourke translated.
Celeste's teeth flashed.
"Of what?"
"Her fame. I have mine. Her husband." Her eyes did not move toward Cadona. This was to her credit, though I could not help observing that the question shifted the air like a curtain stirred by a draught.
"I'm not so foolish as to marry a man who lives in the air," she said lightly. "They never come down."
Poirot, who could change temperature with a smile, warmed the room by a degree.
"Mademoiselle, forgive a small curiosity. Your perfume is of the violets. It is charming. It is also, how shall we say, distinctive. You have many ribbons of that shade?"
She did not glance at her throat.
"I like a token.
It pleases the eye in movement.
Do you ever visit the gallery above the ring?" he asked almost idly. She met his gaze with perfect serenity.
Never. I am a creature of the earth. Ask my horses.
Then, said Poirot, perhaps you can enlighten us about Eddie Malloy and Mademoiselle Cappel.
The clown speaks of them, and the clown sees much.
At the name her composure altered, only a fraction, as when a horse's ear cocks at a fly.
Greta is ambitious, she said, an ambition like a whip, useful in the ring, ugly at supper. She resents Lily. She believes she is owed a place in the light because she was born under the trapeze. She is not owed anything.
Eddie,
she hesitated.
Eddie likes to run where the current is strong.
A boy who hears wires talking.
Are they together?
Today, last week, who knows? He is a spark. It is his profession to jump.
O'Rourke snapped his book shut. We'll find them.
You will not, Celeste said unexpectedly. Not until they decide to be found.
When she had gone, leaving, it seemed to me, a wake of perfume and the faintest suggestion of hoofbeats, O'Rourke exhaled and slapped the desk.
I don't take to her.
You take too much on the tongue, Poirot murmured. It spoils the taste.
She is a woman who knows the value of a still face.
And those ribbons, I ventured. The one we found above, was it hers?
I would not swear so in a court, said Poirot. Perfume is a bad witness. It falls in love with whatever it touches.
We were interrupted by a shout from the corridor. The door flew open to admit a wiry lad with a red neckerchief and the expression of a man who would like to run, but suspects someone has tied his shoelaces together. Behind him, a pair of constables loomed like barn doors.
Name, O'Rourke barked.
Eddie Malloy, said the lad, swallowing.
Sir.
A murmur ran through the performers in the hall. Peepo's painted eye peered around the jam and winked at me as if to say that the ringmaster's whip had cracked on cue.
Where have you been, Mr. Malloy? O'Rourke asked, deceptively mild.
Up top, down below, checking the cue lamps, then it went wrong. I didn't...
His Adam's apple bobbed.
I ran.
Guilty men run, O'Rourke observed.
So do rabbits, said Poirot amiably.
Come, mon petit, sit. You will drink a little water, and then you will tell us why you were on the electrician's ladder when the bell for Madame Lightsell had rung.
I wasn't cutting nothing, Eddie burst out. I swear, on anything you like.
The bell went, and the West Queue lamp didn't fire. That's my lamp. I went up. I heard a noise like a file on a pipe. I looked, and I saw someone where they shouldn't be. I yelled, then...
He swallowed.
Then it went, and she...
His voice broke like a boy's.
Describe the someone, I said gently. It was high at the crown. They was crouched. I saw a glint, like a thin saw. Then they went back into the truss. Could be they took the east ladder. Could be they... He twisted his cap.
Could be I spooked 'em too late.
Man or woman? O'Rourke demanded.
Eddie stared at the floor as if truth might be painted there.
Small, he muttered.
Quick.
Wearing something light about the head, like a scarf.
A ribbon? Poirot suggested.
Maybe, said Eddie. It fluttered.
Did you see Miss Cappel? O'Rourke said suddenly.
Eddie flinched.
Not since dinner.
She had words with Miss Lightsell in the wardrobe. Said Lily was keeping her down. Said,
he looked miserable.
Said the ring is big enough for one star.
Where is Miss Cappel now?
Eddie lifted his hands.
How should I?
She don't tell me.
He stopped, defeated.
I don't know.
Lieutenant, said Poirot softly, you will permit that we also speak with Madame Celeste's groom, this Carlo, and with the fortune-teller whose tent is by the east entrance.
O'Rourke stared.
A fortune-teller?
Yes, said Poirot. When truth hides on a wire, one sometimes begins with prophecy.
Chapter 3. The Cards and the Candle.
I must admit that at that moment I was inclined to share Lieutenant O'Rourke's incredulity. a fortune-teller. Of all the odd corners into which Poirot's fancy had led me over the years, this one seemed the most whimsical. Yet, as I have since learned, nothing in Poirot's mind was ever whim. There were only circles, some larger than others, closing in upon the truth. It was close upon midnight when we stepped outside. The rain that had been threatening all evening had come at last in a fine silver mist, blurring the lamps along the midway. The great canvas dome of the Grand Winter Circus loomed behind us like a ghostly ship run aground in smoke. Poirot drew his coat close about his neck. "Eh bien, Hastings," he murmured, "we have looked to the heights. Now let us stoop a little lower, to the ground and to the mind of man. The stars do not fall alone." O'Rourke grunted. "If this is about getting your boots red, go ahead. I'll take statements from the night watch."
"Merci, mon lieutenant," said Poirot. "I will not keep her long unless she foretells something very interesting."
The fortune-teller's tent stood apart from the performer's wagons, a modest affair painted with chipped constellations and the bold legend Madame Raina. She sees what the eye forgets. Inside, the air was thick with sandalwood and the faint metallic smell of coin polish. A low table was set between two lamps, one burning blue, the other yellow, their mingled light giving the occupant's face an otherworldly shimmer. Madame Raina herself was a woman in her 40s, handsome rather than pretty, her auburn hair wound in braids threaded with tarnished gold. She looked up as we entered, and the single candle between us guttered as if in greeting. "You come from the tent of the dead," she said without preamble. "The air around you trembles." Poirot bowed. "Madame is perceptive." "We come from where tragedy fell, quite literally." Her eyes, dark and steady, moved from him to me and back again. "Two men," she murmured. "One who believes in signs, and one who believes in the man who believes in them. Sit." I sat despite myself. Poirot inclined his head approvingly. "You see, Hastings, already she divines your character." Madame Raina smiled faintly. "It does not take sight to see loyalty." Poirot rested his gloves on the table. "You know, perhaps, of the accident that has happened?"
"Accident?"
She shook her head slowly. The rope was not tired. The air was. She had angered it too many times.
"Tiens!"
Poirot's eyes glimmered. "And who was the wind's accomplice?" Her hand hovered over a deck of cards that lay before her. "The air carries whispers. It said there were two on the wire tonight. One seen, one not seen. One who fell, and one who will fall again." "A riddle," I said impatiently. "A mirror," she corrected. Poirot leaned forward. "Madame, we seek only what you yourself saw, with the eyes, not the spirit. Did anyone pass your tent after the bell for Miss Leitzel's performance?" Her hand stilled. "Many feet pass." "The living, the frightened, and sometimes those who do not know which they are. But I remember the smell of violets." Poirot's expression sharpened almost imperceptibly.
"Ah, violets!"
"Continue, if you please."
"She came quickly," said Madame Raina. "Head high, cloak pulled close. The violets came before her, sweet, then bitter in the rain.
She did not look at me, but she dropped a coin upon my table. A silver dollar, face up. That is a mark among my people, a wish not to be remembered." "And then?"
"Moments later, a man ran past. The electrician boy, the one they call Sparks."
He looked behind him, not ahead. When men look behind them, they have either seen beauty or guilt. His face had neither. Poirot inclined his head. "You are most observant, madame." "You will, I hope, permit me to borrow this coin? It is perhaps a small witness." She pushed it across the table. "Silver remembers." Poirot placed it delicately into his pocketbook and rose. "I thank you. Perhaps I, too, will read the cards one day." As we stepped out into the damp night, he added softly, "Though I suspect I know already what they will say."
We crossed the grounds toward the stables. The smell of hay and oiled leather mingled with the animal warmth that still steamed in the chill air. Somewhere, a horse stamped restlessly. The groom, Carlo, emerged from the shadows carrying a lantern. He was a thick-set man, square as a pillar, with shoulders like a blacksmith's and a face as expressionless as carved wood.
"Signor Poirot," he said uncertainly, "they tell me you ask for me."
"Yes, my friend." Poirot regarded him with that gentleness he reserved for the wary. "You attend the horses of Mademoiselle Celeste Minotti, yes?"
"Since Naples," he said simply. "She rides only what I trust."
"Sultan and Nero, they trust me."
"And tonight where were you when the bell rang for Miss Leitzel's act?"
"In the stable, cleaning the bit." "The lady, Mademoiselle Celeste, was with Sultan. She talk, always talk to him before she perform. Say it calm the blood."
"Did anyone come near?"
Carlo considered. "The little blonde, Greta. She come, ask for Celeste. I say she is not free. Greta, she make a face and go. After that, only the boy with wires. He run by, shouting something. Then the screaming starts."
Poirot nodded.
"And afterwards?"
"After Celeste go to the ring, I follow. She see Alfredo, she cry. I take the horses away, that is all."
"Carlo," Poirot said, "you love your mistress, yes?"
The big man's jaw tightened.
"I serve her."
"It is often the same thing," murmured Poirot. "Tell me, what perfume does she wear?"
He looked surprised.
"Always the violets."
"Why not?"
"It suit her. The bottle she get from Paris. I fetch it once. Price like a diamond."
"Merci, mon ami." Poirot touched his arm with almost paternal kindness. "You are a man of strength. Use it now to remember."
"The bottle, it is glass or crystal?"
"Crystal, small. Stopper with a silver bow." Poirot smiled. "I am content." When Carlo had gone, I turned to him in exasperation. "Perfume bottles, coins, prophecies. Are you truly any nearer to discovering who cut that wire?"
He glanced up at the black hulk of the tent where the last lamps were being extinguished.
"The night, Hastings, is a stage upon which each actor plays his cue. I have merely learned who stood in the wings." The following morning dawned gray and cold. Chicago looked hungover from the excitement of tragedy. The newspapers screamed of the death of the aerial queen. I accompanied Poirot to the little hotel where we lodged, expecting him to breakfast in silence, but he was curiously talkative, discoursing upon circus sociology with the enthusiasm of a man describing a puzzle he had almost fitted together.
"Observe," he said, buttering his roll with geometrical precision. "The circus is a microcosm of the world. There is the ring, society itself, where appear the admired and the envied. There is the manager, who represents government. He arranges, he taxes, he manipulates. There are the clowns, the philosophers, who laugh because otherwise they would cry. And above all, there is the wire, Hastings, the line between life and death. Upon it, all walk."
"And the murderer?" I asked. Poirot looked pained.
"Do not hurry the curtain, mon ami. Even in the theater of crime, timing is everything." He spent the morning among the performers' caravans, making inquiries that seemed to me to flutter aimlessly from one odd corner to another. The quartermaster who sold lamp oil, the dressmaker who stitched sequins, the small boy who swept the sawdust. Yet by noon, a subtle animation had crept into his manner. His eyes, usually sleepy at that hour, were alert, his moustache almost buoyant. At luncheon he announced, "We shall go now to see the Bureau d'Assurance and after the shop of Monsieur Leroy."
"Insurance and jewellers," I exclaimed.
"What on earth connects those?"
"The air, Hastings."
"The air connects all things." The insurance office proved to be a sober establishment overlooking Michigan Avenue. A thin clerk produced the relevant documents with the politeness of one accustomed to tragedy wrapped in paperwork. Poirot examined the policy with delicate fingers.
Uh-huh, he said. The life of Madame Leitzell insured for $25,000, payable to the circus company. But here, an addendum of last month, $5,000 to her husband personally. Très intéressant. And this signature witnessed by Mademoiselle Minotti. The clerk nodded. They were all present. Mrs. Leitzell said it was to ease Mr. Cadona's mind. Ah, but the mind is not always eased by money, murmured Poirot. From there we proceeded to the jeweler's, a narrow shop filled with brass tools and the smell of oil. The proprietor, Monsieur Leroy, was a dapper Parisian exile with the mournful dignity of a displaced craftsman. Poirot greeted him in French, and they conversed rapidly. Presently the little man fetched from a drawer a small frame saw, its teeth fine as sand. "I sold two last week," he explained. "One to a watchmaker, one to a lady of the circus, Mademoiselle Capelle. She said she cut wire for costumes. I advised gloves." Poirot's eyes gleamed. "Très bien. Did she pay in cash?" "With a silver dollar, face up," said the jeweler. Poirot's smile deepened to satisfaction. He thanked the man and took my arm as we stepped into the street. "You see, Hastings, even prophecy must leave a receipt." We returned to the circus in the late afternoon. Rehearsals had been cancelled. The big tent stood half open, its benches deserted. Cadona was there alone, sitting in the sawdust where his wife had fallen. He did not rise as we approached. Poirot halted a little way off, his expression grave. "Monsieur," he said gently, "forgive that we intrude upon sorrow. But I must ask you one question. The life of Madame, her insurance, you knew of the change?" Cadona lifted his head. His eyes were red-rimmed but steady. "I knew," he said. "She wanted me safe if anything happened. I told her it was nonsense. She made me sign anyway." "Did you perhaps sign also as witness for the manager?" "No, Celeste did." "Ah." Poirot's tone was unreadable. "And the perfume she wore, it was the same as your wife's?" He gave a weary smile. "They both liked the same things. Fame, applause, violets." Poirot regarded him a long moment. "Thank you, monsieur. Grief is a veil. It can hide or reveal. I pray yours does the kinder thing." He turned away, and we left the widower amid the empty ring. Outside, the fog had thickened, swallowing the fairground lights one by one. The painted faces on the circus posters looked blurred and mournful, as though the rain had given them tears. Poirot paused beneath the dripping eaves of the tent. "Mon pauvre Hastings," he said quietly. "We have spoken with prophets and grooms, with widowers and perfumes, and still the truth walks the wire unseen."
"You mean you're no nearer?" I asked.
"Nearer, yes, but not yet arrived." His eyes followed the dark curve of the canvas above. "Jealousy, money, pride, these are but gusts of wind. I seek the hand that directed them." Across the yard, Celeste Minotti emerged from the stables, veiled and gloved, her gait unhurried, her poise immaculate. Even through the drizzle, a breath of violets reached us. Poirot's gaze followed her until she vanished into the shadows. "A woman who knows she is watched," he murmured. "Moves slowly so that suspicion grows tired. It is a useful art." We walked on toward the police post, where Lieutenant O'Rourke stood beneath a lantern, collar up, mustache drooping with fatigue. "Your circus folk talk all night, Mr. Poirot," he grumbled. "Every one of them could have done it, and everyone swears they loved her." Poirot smiled faintly. "Ah, but love, mon lieutenant, is often merely vanity dressed for the stage." O'Rourke eyed him warily. "Then what do you call hate?" "Love's understudy," said Poirot, "always waiting in the wings." He tipped his hat, and we left the man staring after us. Chapter 4. The Husband and the Missing Girl.
The morning broke pale and brittle. A haze hung over Chicago, dulling the sunlight into pewter. Poirot stood at the window of our hotel, hands clasped neatly behind his back, staring down at the waking street with an expression I knew well. The calm before his little grey cells began to dance.
"Today, Hastings," he said, turning, "we shall speak with the husband again. There are questions that grief, when first asked, cannot answer, but later, when the tears have dried, it remembers too much. And after that..." He adjusted his tie with precision. "We must find the little blonde. Mademoiselle Greta Kappel has chosen a most inconvenient moment to vanish." At the circus grounds, the bustle of dismantling had resumed. Canvas flapped like weary sails. The smell of horses and sawdust mingled with the faint tang of rusting metal. The posters of the late Miss Leitzel still hung limp and rain-streaked, their bright colors running like tears. Lieutenant O'Rourke met us at the gate, his expression grim. "Your missing understudy's done a disappearing act," he said without ceremony. "No sign of her since last night. Her wagon's empty, trunk gone. One of the drivers swears he saw a girl boarding a freight at dawn near Canal Street." Poirot raised his brows. "You permit such departures in a murder inquiry?" O'Rourke spread his hands. "We can't watch every rail car in Chicago." "Then we must look where she did not intend to be seen," said Poirot quietly. "A runaway's path often circles back to what she fears most." Alfredo Cadona awaited us inside the deserted performer's lounge, a narrow space lined with mirrors and half-packed trunks. The smell of cold grease paint clung to the walls. He looked older than his 40 years, his once dashing face drawn and grey. "She's gone, isn't she?" he said hoarsely, before we had spoken a word. "The little one, Greta. I told them she'd run. She was frightened of something."
"Of what, monsieur?" Poirot asked gently.
Cadona's hands tightened around a cigarette he never lit.
"Of me, perhaps.
Or of her own ambition. Lily. She humiliated her once, in front of the company. Said she'd never have the grace to fly above a crowd. Greta never forgave her." Poirot's head tilted.
"And you, monsieur? Did you forgive your wife for the humiliations she gave you?"
For a moment, Cardona's composure cracked. "You think I killed her? That I'd do that to Lily?" Poirot's tone softened. "I think perhaps you loved her beyond reason, and reason is the one thing that keeps men from doing dreadful acts."
Cardona turned away, staring at a faded photograph on the wall. Leitzel mid-spin, her face lifted to the light.
"You don't understand," he muttered. "She was everything I wasn't anymore."
When my shoulder gave out, she kept climbing higher. The crowd wanted her, not me, but I'd rather have been hated by her than pitied. Poirot said nothing. The silence stretched until it trembled. At last, Cardona spoke again. "Greta used to come to her wagon at night, begging for a chance to take the act if Lily was ill. Lily would laugh, that cruel, tinkling laugh of hers. I told Greta to keep away. She started drinking, sneaking out after shows. Last week she said someone in the troupe had promised her a shortcut to the spotlight."
God knows what she meant.
Poirot's gaze sharpened. "A shortcut, oui. That is a phrase which may illuminate much." He stepped closer. "Tell me, monsieur, on the night of the fall, when you saw your wife ascend, what did you see besides her?"
Cardona blinked.
"The ring light, the crowd, the band. What else is there to see?"
"There is always one thing more," said Poirot. "We are blind only to what we love too dearly."
Cadona stared at him as if about to protest, then looked away, his shoulders sagging. Outside, O'Rourke was waiting, impatience written across every inch of him.
"Well?" he demanded. "The husband still saintly?"
"Ah," Poirot murmured. "He is no saint, but saints seldom marry angels, and Madame Leitzel was one only in her height."
"Greta's the key now," O'Rourke said, "if she's not halfway to St. Louis."
Poirot's eyes glittered. "Perhaps she is closer than you think." We returned to the fortune-teller's tent. The flap was tied open, the interior dark except for the yellow lamp that burned perpetually beside a table strewn with cards. Madame Raina was there, turning one slowly between her fingers. The Queen of Hearts, upside down. "She comes and goes," the woman said without greeting. "Who, madam?" "The child with the pale hair. She has been here."
"When?"
"Before the sun rose." She left a question behind and took nothing but fear. Poirot's voice was low. "And the question?" Madame Raina tapped the card. "She asked whether betrayal can also be forgiven."
"And what did you answer?"
"That depends," she said, "on whether the betrayed lives to forgive." Poirot gave a short bow. "Merci, madame. You have the rare gift of speaking nonsense that may later prove prophetic." Back at the ring, the workers were coiling cables. Poirot's eye caught on one that gleamed differently, its end freshly cut, though not used in the main act. He knelt, fingered the edge. "New steel, Hastings." A replacement, and hastily installed. Someone feared discovery.
"You think Greta..."
He straightened. "Perhaps. Or perhaps someone who wished her disappearance to be convenient. There is guilt in absence, but guilt also in silence." He brushed off his gloves. "Tonight we shall find her. Not on a train, but where fear hides best, in the shadows of success." That evening the circus grounds lay hushed, the tense black silhouettes against the lake's faint glow. Poirot moved like a shadow himself, listening to the faint hum of wires above. Then, from the direction of the empty animal pens, a cry pierced the stillness. We ran. A figure stumbled from the gloom, a young woman, disheveled, her hair unpinned, her face streaked with dirt and tears. It was Greta Kappel. She clutched the flap of her coat around her and stared at us with wild, frightened eyes.
"You must believe me," she gasped. "I didn't mean to hurt her.
I only wanted them to see me." Poirot lifted his hand. "Doucement, mademoiselle. You will tell us everything. But first, sit. The ground, she is safer than the heights." Greta sank to her knees, sobbing, and Poirot looked at me across the darkness, his expression unreadable. "Do not look so certain, Hastings," he said softly. "Confession is often only another kind of performance." Chapter 5. The Circus Sleeps. For several minutes no one spoke. The girl crouched there in the half-light, her breath catching in little gasps, like a bird too frightened to fly. Poirot, still as a statue, regarded her with that grave patience that always made me feel both comforted and uneasy. Rain whispered against the canvas above us, and somewhere a horse stamped, restless in its stall. At last he said, "Come, mademoiselle, we will move indoors." Tears dry faster in a chair than in the mud. Inside the ringmaster's office, the gas lamp burned low, throwing long, trembling shadows across the walls. O'Rourke joined us, grumbling but obedient, and shut the door against the wind. Greta sat hunched near the stove, her coat steaming faintly. Her hands were still shaking, the knuckles white against the fabric. "Now then," said O'Rourke, taking out his notebook, "let's have it from the start." "Where have you been since last night?" Greta's eyes darted from him to Poirot. "Hiding," she said faintly, "by the lake." "I thought they'd think I'd gone. I wanted to go, but I couldn't. Not yet."
"Because of guilt?" O'Rourke asked sharply.
"Because of fear," said Poirot, before she could answer. "Continue, mademoiselle." Greta swallowed. "After the fall, after she..." She pressed her hands to her face. "I ran." Everyone was screaming. "I didn't know what to do. I thought they'd blame me. Lily always said they would if anything happened to her. She said I'd kill her one day with my jealousy."
Poirot's gaze did not waver.
You were jealous? Greta gave a bitter laugh. Who wasn't? She was perfect. Even her mistakes were applauded. And Alfredo, he saw only her. You think I wanted to take her place in the act? I only wanted them to know I could. Her voice cracked, and for a moment she seemed very young, hardly more than a child playing at tragedy. Poirot leaned forward slightly. Mademoiselle, when you said last night that you did not mean to hurt her, what did you mean by that? Her fingers tightened on the blanket. It wasn't me who touched the wire. I swear it, I saw someone. She stopped trembling violently. You saw what? Said O'Rourke. Greta shook her head. No. If I say it, they'll kill me too. Who? I demanded. But she only covered her face and whispered, You don't know this place. The circus protects its own. Poirot rose, smoothed his cuffs, and signaled to O'Rourke. You will have her watched, my lieutenant, but gently. Like a frightened cat. If she runs, she will never stop. If you push, she will bite. Let her rest. O'Rourke muttered something unflattering in Irish and led Greta away. When the door had closed, Poirot turned to me. His face was thoughtful, not triumphant. She is not the murderer, he said simply. Not yet. But she holds a thread in her shaking hands, and if we follow it, perhaps we find who pulls. Later that morning, the circus lay under a pale sky, streaked with steam from the animal pens. The smell of damp hay, oil, and rosin clung to everything. Workmen moved like ghosts between wagons. The bright paint of the carousels looked dull and cracked in the cold light. Codona was in the ring again, moving with a strange mechanical precision. He was supervising the dismantling of the trapeze frame, his wife's final stage. I thought it heartless, but Poirot watched in silence. Grief, Hastings, he murmured, takes many disguises. Some weep, some work. It is only idleness that betrays guilt. When Codona saw us, he came down the ladder, wiping his hands. His eyes were bloodshot, but the grim set of his jaw had returned. They tell me you found the girl, he said. She talked. She cried, said Poirot. It is not the same thing. She should be locked up, he muttered. She hated Lily. Everyone knew it. Always hanging about the riggers, asking questions, trying to learn the act. Did she succeed? Asked Poirot quietly. Codona hesitated. No one can learn that spin. Lily was born to it. Yet someone else understood the mechanics, said Poirot. Enough to make the rope fail at precisely the right instant. The man's expression darkened. You think I don't see where you're going? Go on then, say it. You think I did it. Poirot met his gaze calmly. I think, monsieur, that you loved your wife, and that love sometimes kills more surely than hate. Codona's shoulders sagged. You talk in riddles, little man. He turned away, gripping the edge of the platform. All I ever wanted was for her to come down to earth again. By midday, word had spread through the camp that Greta was in custody. Celeste Minotti's wagon stood open, and a small crowd of performers lingered nearby. She emerged dressed immaculately in grey, as if the morning were a stage and she its leading lady. Monsieur Poirot, she said coolly, I hear your little dove has been found. And what does she sing? Only lullabies, said Poirot. But even those can soothe the guilty to sleep. Her eyes glittered. How poetic. You must be enjoying this. An audience of suspects and you their ringmaster. I assure you, he said, I prefer applause at the end, not during the act. She smiled faintly. Then you must work faster. By tomorrow, there may be no circus left to applaud. Poirot studied her for a long moment. Tell me, madame, what becomes of the horses now that the show is finished?
They will travel south, she said, as will I. Chicago grows cold. And yet, murmured Poirot, the scent of violets lingers in the air.
Celeste gave a small, contemptuous laugh. "You flatter my perfume, monsieur. It lingers because people prefer the smell of fantasy to that of truth." She swept past us, her coat trailing the faintest trace of that familiar sweetness. Poirot's eyes followed her until she vanished beyond the tents. That evening in our hotel, Poirot sat by the window, fingertips pressed together. Outside, the rain had ceased, but the city lights wavered like dying embers across the slick streets. "Greta lies, Hastings," he said at last, "but so does everyone else. It is only that her lies are clumsy and the others are dressed for performance." "Then you think someone else cut the wire?" He sighed. "Think." "No, no, not yet. The truth, she hides behind the curtain still. But tomorrow..." He tapped the window glass lightly. "Tomorrow we raise it." He smiled faintly at my expression. "And when it rises, my friend, prepare yourself. The scene will not be pretty." He turned off the lamp, and the room sank into darkness. Outside, the last of the circus lights flickered once more, like dying stars over an empty stage. Chapter 6. The Final Performance. The next morning dawned like tarnished silver over the lake, flat, breathless, and cold. The circus field was a graveyard of color, scraps of bunting in the mud, the smell of oil and damp hay, the hush of workmen who spoke only in whispers. The great tent, half-lowered, loomed like a monument waiting for its own burial. Lieutenant O'Rourke had assembled everyone beneath that sagging roof. Cadona, hollow-eyed and defiant. Celeste Minotti, composed and veiled in grey. Greta Kappel, pale and miserable. And Chapman, the rigger, who looked as though he would rather be mending than listening. Even the boy electrician, Sparks, hovered near the entrance, a silent witness absolved but still uneasy. Poirot entered last, immaculate amid the sawdust, hat in hand. "Mesdames, messieurs," he began gently, "we meet once more, not for accusation, but for truth. She too must take her bow before the tent comes down." He went to a trestle table where a coil of steel cable lay coiled like a sleeping serpent, its broken end bright against the black cloth. Beside it rested a jeweler's lens, a metronome, and two fine frame saws. "This cable," he said, "was thought to have betrayed its mistress. In truth, it was betrayed by her companions. Look, two wounds, one shallow and ragged, one clean and deliberate, each made at a different hour, each by a different hand." He turned the cable under the lamp. "The first cut, the hurried one, was done the morning of the performance. The second dates from rehearsal 2 days before. The steel remembers." Chapman muttered, "Could beware from packing." "Non, monsieur. We examined your fittings together last night. Your conscience, like your craft, is sound. You are cleared." The big man gave a brief nod and stepped back, relief stiffening his shoulders. Poirot continued. "Alone, either wound might have held. Together, they became destiny. Voila, two ambitions meeting in midair." He lifted one of the saws. "The first belonged to Mademoiselle Kappel." Greta's breath caught. I couldn't. "You could," said Poirot softly, "and you did. You purchased this tool from Monsieur Leroy, paying with a silver dollar, face up. The same coin Madame Raina gave me, the same that linked your path to her tent. You wished to prove yourself, to show the troupe, the press, perhaps even the great Alfredo Cordona, that you too could dance with gravity and win. You thought to nick the cable just enough to jar the queen from her throne. Un petit frisson, a stumble, not a death." Greta's eyes filled. "I only wanted them to see me." "Yes." "And you chose the one thing that no one would see until too late." He set down the saw and turned to Celeste Minotti. "But there was an older wound and a steadier hand." Celeste's veil did not move. "Madame," Poirot said gently, "yours was the deeper cut."
You made it 2 days earlier, during rehearsal. You feared that Lily Leitzel's pride would destroy the man you loved. You wished to frighten her, to bring her down a little, to earth, to humility, to him. You used the small trimming blade you keep for harness leather. You knew precisely where to weaken the steel. Your loyal groom, Carlo, hung a charm of ribbon for luck in the rigging, and its knot still carried your perfume. That is how your scent reached the heights. A murmur ran through the onlookers. Celeste slowly removed her gloves and looked at the palms, as though the marks might still be there. "I meant only a warning," she said quietly. "A lesson." Poirot bowed his head. And Mademoiselle Greta, impatient to make her own mark, cut from the opposite side, right-handed. "You, left." The two lines met like crossing blades, each alone harmless, together fatal. The wire snapped exactly when admiration was loudest, as if the gods had timed the applause. Cadorna stepped forward. "You're saying both of them?" "Yes," said Poirot softly. "Each acted alone, believing her intention innocent. Between them, they built the perfect trap." Celeste's voice broke its composure. "He was breaking under her fame, monsieur. I wanted to save him." "You loved me," Cadorna said hoarsely, "and so you killed her." She met his gaze with a steadiness that was almost pity. "No, Alfredo. I killed what was killing you. The rest, God finished." Greta buried her face in her hands. "I swear I never meant..." Poirot raised a hand. "None of you meant it." That, alas, is the oldest refrain in the world. O'Rourke cleared his throat. "The law'll see both stand trial." "Of course," said Poirot. "Justice must mend what conscience cannot." Celeste turned to him. "Monsieur Poirot, one last thing. The husband? He will be kind?" Poirot's expression was unreadable. "Kindness is not in my gift, madame. Only truth." When they led the women away, Greta stumbled. Celeste walked upright, the faint smell of violets trailing after her like memory. Cadorna watched without moving, the photograph of his wife crumpled in his fist. Poirot lingered as the tent emptied. He gazed upward to where the cable had once hung, now a single dark scar against the light. "Two cuts, Hastings," he said quietly. "Two acts of love in disguise, ambition and protection. Together they made the symmetry of tragedy." "And the fortune-teller?" I asked. "She was right then? Two on the wire?" Poirot smiled faintly. "Prophecy, mon ami, is only observation spoken poetically. She smelled the truth before we did." He placed the silver dollar on a crate near the ring, face down. "For humility," he murmured. "It is the only wire on which man may walk without falling." Outside, the city lights shimmered faintly through the mist. The last of the canvas sagged. A single lamp hissed out. Poirot adjusted his hat, and we turned toward the road. "Come, Hastings," he said. "The curtain has fallen. And the applause, she is over." And together we walked into the thin, clean air of morning, leaving behind the ghosts of those who had flown too high. And so concludes Poirot and the Fall from Heaven, a story of jealousy, ambition, and the deadly symmetry of love gone astray. This tale was written by us in homage to Agatha Christie and inspired by the true tragedy of Lillian Leitzel and Alfredo Cadorna, whose love and rivalry continue to echo through circus history. If you've listened until the end, then you are the reason these mysteries continue. Your presence, feedback, and reflections keep Nocturnal Tales alive. Tell us below, what kind of spooky mystery would you like to hear next week for Halloween? Would you prefer a ghostly Poirot case or a completely different detective facing something beyond reason? If you'd like to support further, you can join our membership for ad-free episodes and extras,
or leave a small tip via Buy Me a Coffee, but simply by listening, liking, and sharing, you're already helping to keep these stories alive in the dark. Until our next mystery, good night.